It's Tuesday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Turkey's increasing threat from Islamic State.
There are opportunities as well as threats, but certainly this is something that they can't afford to be complacent about at all.
European leaders meet to help preserve the EU. Also ahead, Donald Trump revisits his controversial immigration policy. South Korea hopes to avoid some of Brazil's Olympic pitfalls and a summer camp for Broadway. It's all on today's International Edition. Turkey is backing away from claims that a child suicide bomber sent by Islamic State carried out Saturday's blast at a Kurdish wedding that killed 54 people. Prime Minister Binali Yildirim on Monday said speculation that a child was responsible was based on rumors from witnesses. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had earlier described the bomber as being between 12 and 14 years old and sent by Islamic State. Nearly all the victims were Kurds younger than age 18. No one has claimed responsibility, but the style of the attack and the type of bomb used were similar to previous blasts blamed on Islamic State. This latest attack comes just 5 weeks after a failed military coup that the Turkish government blamed on supporters of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. Regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania says that if this was an Islamic State-inspired attack, it may be in retaliation for gains made on the battlefield by Kurdish fighters in Syria.
Since there have been setbacks for ISIS in Syria as a result of Kurdish fighters gaining territory from ISIS, Kurdish forces that are supported by the United States and have had the ability to move across the Turkish border. It's hard to believe they have direct support from Erdogan since he's conducting a war against the Kurds with his other hand. But ISIS appears to think that the Turks could stop the Kurds from fighting them in Syria, and they're not. So I think ISIS is attacking Turkey to try to get Turkey to crush the Kurds and also to warn Turkey not to become involved in the Syrian civil war in a way that would threaten ISIS. It's happening against the background of the Erdogan government conducting a purge of its own movement. Its movement, an Islamic movement that has taken power and ruled Turkey more or less democratically, but in recent years less and less democratically, came to power in part because of an alliance with this movement that is called the Gulen movement. Gulen is a preacher who now lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. He was originally a strong ally of Erdogan, and his whole movement, which includes economic and business and social ties and networks of people in the educational system, in the military, all of these groups are groups that Erdogan decided he no longer wanted to be in a position to rival him. What Erdogan has done is he's told the Turks something very hard to understand, that ISIS, the Kurds, and the Gulenists are all the same. They're enemies of Turkey. I do think that ISIS is on the downslide. They are suffering now. It reverses, but that doesn't mean that they can't lash out in extremely destructive ways, as they showed with this last attack. I am expecting more violence, and I think more violence from more quarters, including those who will sympathize with the tens of thousands of Turkish civil servants and military officers who are now being imprisoned. Erdogan released over 30,000 prisoners just to make room for all those he's been purging from the upper ranks of Turkish civil society. This is very hard to predict where this is going to end.
Regional analyst Ian Lustig of the University of Pennsylvania. U.S. Olympic swimming medalist Ryan Lochte has lost two major sponsors after admitting he had exaggerated claims about being robbed in Brazil. As VOA's G. Abby Lee joins us in the studio to find out the social media reaction, it definitely has not been a good day for the Olympic swimming medalist.
Hi, Jim.
Well, it looks like swimmer Ryan Lochte's week did not quite start off on the right note.
Well, doesn't it? Lochte lost a number of sponsorships after distorting a story about him vandalizing a gas station in Brazil to turn the blame to the locals. Speedo speedily dropped him. The UK-based swimwear manufacturer announced a decision on both Twitter and Facebook, and this is part of the announcement. We cannot condone behavior that is counter to the values this brand has long stood for. The company plans to donate $50,000 from Lochte's fee to a children's charity in Brazil. And after that announcement, many social media users urged the American fashion house Ralph Lauren to follow suit, and it did.
Wow. Well, any news on the political front?
There always is. It's a gift that keeps on giving,
yes.
Or at least until the election day. GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump sent out two tweets targeting the left-leaning station MSNBC. He tweeted, "Tried watching low-rated at morning underscore Joe this morning. Unwatchable. At morning Mika is off the wall, an erotic and not very bright mess." He's referring to one of the hosts for the show, Mika Brzezinski. Trump also insinuated a romantic relationship between the two hosts, Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. Scarborough replied, "Thanks for watching. Morning Joe is enjoying its best ratings ever, thanks to obsessed fans like you. Glad," and he topped it off with a smiley face.
Well, we'll have more of Mr. Trump in International Edition in a little bit, but anything else trending?
Another politics story, but this time involving Hillary Clinton. Conservative watchdog organization Judicial Watch claimed Bahrain's crown prince tried to meet her through the Clinton Foundation. It released a 2009 email allegedly from Clinton aide Huma Abedin to a foundation employee to set up a meeting for Salman bin Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, who gave a $100,000 donation. And critics argued online that this shows she will have too many quote-unquote obligations to past donors. Jim, back to you.
Well, quite a busy day online. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. You may tweet us your comments and questions to @VOA_IE. That is our International Edition Twitter stream. And you'll find myself and G on Twitter as well, @VOA Stevenson and @G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, the United Nations says North Korea is appeared to resume plutonium production this year. U.S.-South Korea begin annual military drill despite threats from Pyongyang. Afghan and India leaders vow to deepen cooperation in fighting terrorism. Japanese Prime Minister Abe wows Rio finale as Super Mario. And Pyeongchang Olympics working to avoid Rio mishaps. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our website, voanews.com. And if you have a smartphone, check out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Leaders of the so-called Big Three of the European Union, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President François Hollande, and host Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, have met Monday off of the Italian coast to discuss ways to keep the European project on track in the wake of Britain's June referendum to leave the 28-nation bloc and rising Euroscepticism. This second meeting, following the first in Berlin, is seen as preparatory for an EU-wide summit in Bratislava on the post-Brexit way forward next month. The meeting took place as some of the EU's remaining 27 members, including the Netherlands, resist even closer integration. In Australia, Monash University European analyst Ben Wellings tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Brexit is viewed by some European leaders as having the potential to disrupt or even derail the European project.
It also has the potential to enliven it and bring it closer to the people, maybe make it less contentious. So there are opportunities as well as threats, but certainly this is something that they can't afford to be complacent about at all.
Ben, how likely is a referendum in some of these other EU countries like the Netherlands?
Well, I think it would be resisted very hard. Referendums, of course, are not a popular tool of European leaders or status quo European leaders. Ever since the 2005 referendum went against the draft constitutional treaty in France and the Netherlands. Places like the Netherlands and France do have this kind of groundswell of Eurosceptic opinion, so I think that they would be avoided. And you remember this time last year in 2015, the Greek people voted against accepting a bailout package and it was forced on them anyway. So I think that there would be considerable pressure not to hold another referendum yet again. The question is whether that will then increase the pressure for it because it will be seen as a denial of a democratic right. So status quo leaders will want to remain in control of the process by holding off the idea of another referendum.
Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban has called for a referendum on October 2nd.
He has, and of course he's not a status quo leader at all, and this is one of the areas where those people around Hollande, Merkel and Renzi may lose control of the process. Renzi himself is embroiled in a referendum of his own choosing about constitutional reform in Italy, nothing to do with the EU, which may go against him, and he may lose that and he may step down. So Orban is calling for a referendum in order to put pressure on the whole migration deal that the Commission has been trying to sort out since last August. So these are the way that now referendums have tended to be used by peoples or politicians or parties that want to challenge the EU's status quo and to disrupt things, just in the way that Syriza did to no effect, of course, in the bailout package agreements last year. So they will pop up. In some ways, the French presidential election next year in May, if Le Pen gets into that, will be in some ways a referendum about France's future in the EU. So definitely the pressure is out there. But those people who want to retain control of the process around the new big three, France, Germany and Italy, will resist this.
Germany also faces a general election next year. While Mr. Renzi has staked his political future on an Italian constitutional referendum that critics say will further centralize political power, the Prime Minister has indicated he could resign if it fails. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is demanding that an independent special prosecutor immediately investigate Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's foundation, saying that the FBI cannot be trusted to do the job. Trump spent much of a Monday campaign speech in Akron, Ohio, on what he describes as the vast scope of Hillary Clinton's criminality, saying that he's shocked by it. Clinton's Republican opponents allege that big donors to the charitable foundation used it to get special access to Clinton or her top aides while she was Secretary of State. Clinton has always denied the charge. Meanwhile, Donald Trump says he's holding firm on his views to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States, one of his main campaign planks in the November election against Democrat Hillary Clinton, although his new campaign manager has said that Trump's deportation plans are to be determined. Trump's tough talk on illegal immigrants and the stream of undocumented migrants entering the country helped fuel his run to the Republican presidential nomination. But Donald Trump is now trailing badly to Clinton among minority voters, according to national political surveys. And in the past few days, he's been making a new pitch to court support among African Americans and Hispanics. VOA's Ken Bredemeyer talks about Trump's undocumented immigrant plan with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
This morning, however, he said, "I'm not flip-flopping." He's not flip-flopping in the sense that he is still holding on to the idea of deporting the 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. Now, whether he actually changes the policy in the coming days, that's certainly who knows. But he's holding firm. And the reason this issue came up is that his new campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, when asked about the same issue just a day ago, said, "to be determined." So Trump was left to try to explain, well, what is to be determined? And he said, "I'm not flip-flopping." So we'll have to see.
Yeah, it seems that Ms. Conway is, you know, she's publicly coming forward with this. I think it seems like she's trying to indicate that since she assumed command of the campaign, that, you know, there's somewhat of a change or sort of a more muted response by Mr. Trump.
She certainly is trying to make her chosen candidate. She did work for somebody else in the Republican primaries, but she's now with Trump. And she, in her mission, obviously, is to make him as acceptable to as many millions of voters as she can. And Trump trails in the polls. He has to do better and make himself more acceptable to the masses, not just the people who handed him the Republican nomination.
VOA's Ken Breedemeyer. Black Girls Vote is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and it encourages young African American women to become active voters. Since its inception last November, Black Girls Vote has registered more than 10,500 voters. But as Faith Lapidus narrates this report by Faiza El-Masri, the organization's bigger goal goes way beyond just mobilizing voters.
The presidential election is less than 3 months away. And while some Americans already know who they plan to vote for, others are still undecided. And then there are others who are just reluctant to participate. Nikedra Nike Robinson, founder of Black Girls Vote, sees that reluctance in many young African American women, despite the growing power of the minority vote.
We know that in 2008 and 2012, that is Black women that delivered the presidency. You know, 76% of African American women were registered to vote, with 70% of them voting, according to the Center for American Progress.
So why would young African American women between the ages of 19 and 25 stay home on Election Day?
Sometimes they don't understand the power of voting and what voting is and how it impacts their day-to-day life.
The key, she says, is showing them the connection between their vote and their daily life. For example, affecting the government response to a murder in their neighborhood.
Whether it's street police patrolling in that community, whether it's light in that park across the street from me, or whether it's more economic opportunities for African-American men, that's tied to policy.
The grassroots organization meets women where they are.
I came today to get registered to vote and become a member of Black Girls Vote.
Kiara Banks, who is studying to become a certified medical assistant, has never voted before.
I think it's time for a change.
Keisha Addison, her classmate, is working full-time and raising three kids. She's been voting since she was 19 years old.
I do vote locally and for every presidential election.
Addison is considering joining Black Girls Vote because she believes that younger women are not politically motivated. She says her 21-year-old daughter is an example. She doesn't want to vote.
She just wanted someone that was actually had a voice for the youth and was concerned about the voice of the youth. So I was telling her that regardless of who you vote for, you need to vote. The vote counts no matter where you put it.
Every day will be a pizza and ice cream party.
To get that message across to the community, group members plan events like this one.
Hi, my name is Naya, and today I'll be running for president of the United States.
Children in Kids Zone, a summer program, elect a class president.
Once we teach them early, and so when they go home, they're going to say, Ma, I voted for the president today. Not president of the United States, but president of the Kids Safe Zone. So come November, when they hear about voting, Mom, you need to go vote too.
Group founder Nikedra Robinson says teaching younger generations about the democratic process is crucial to help them understand why their vote counts, how choosing candidates who represent their views can bring positive change to their communities. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Visit voanews.com for more on this story, and be sure to follow us online on Twitter at @VOA_IE, and you can like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or Take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Organizers of the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea are working to avoid the criticisms of delays and disorganization that had plagued the Rio Games. VOA's Brian Patton visited the Pyeongchang region that will host the Games and reports that construction is proceeding on schedule on new sporting venues and infrastructure projects that make up the majority of the $12 billion budget for this sports event.
Construction crews in Pyeongchang are working to complete the new Olympic stadium, the bobsled track, and other facilities. The ski jump tower is already in place. The downhill ski race course was carved out of a protected forest on South Korea's tallest mountain over the protest of environmentalists. Organizers say they want to avoid the last-minute problems encountered in Rio by completing all the venues by September of 2017 and holding test events in advance of the Games.
We are making an effort to ensure the Pyeongchang Olympics will be progressive and successful by having learned from Rio as a reference.
Highway expansion work, which is causing daily traffic jams in the region, and the construction of a new high-speed train that will cut 3 hours of travel time from Seoul, are the most expensive Olympic projects. Some local residents worry taxes will go up to pay for the Olympics and have complained their rents have increased due to the influx of workers into the region.
We hope the Olympic Organization Committee will take a look at our situation again and take care of our concerns.
The Alpensia Ski Resort will be the central hub of the Winter Olympics, with media centers nearby and lodging reserved for high-ranking officials and sponsors. However, there are no plans for new housing. Many participants and spectators will have to stay 40 kilometers west in the coastal city of Gangneung. The city of 200,000 will also host the ice skating events. Five new ice rinks are being built that will be operated for public use after the Games. The organizing committee has opened a visitor center in Gangneung to generate public interest in the Winter Games.
Actually, the Winter Olympics is not really popular in Asia, so this is very important for us to promote and what is the Winter Olympics.
Tourists who come for the Games can also explore Korea's ancient culture and practice quiet meditation at a 642-year-old Buddhist temple in the mountains of Pyeongchang. Brian Patton, VOA News, Pyeongchang.
A little bit difficult to think about winter when most of the northern hemisphere is in the middle of summer. And at this time of year, camp between the school years is a ritual for many American kids. A unique camp in the Washington area offers an opportunity to some aspiring teenage artists to get a taste of what it takes to make it onto Broadway. VOA's Jun So has more on young artists of American's musical theater intensive summer camp in this report narrated by Carol Pearson.
I want to make magic. I want to be bigger than I am.
Ari Goldbloom-Helsner is rehearsing the lead role in the stage musical based on the 1980 film Fame. He's one of 39 teenagers participating in a musical theater program that runs from 8 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. During the day, the students take dancing, acting, and singing classes. And in the evening, they apply everything they've learned to the actual production.
Very intensive, and I think that's the part that's most exhausting, but also the part that I most love.
The overnight camp program is run by the Young Artists of America. Opera singer Rolando Sanz co-founded the organization, which also offers programs during the school year.
We're entering our sixth year. What I love about this program and what it's becoming is that we're attracting the kids that really want to excel and to be around other kids like them.
The participants learn skills and techniques from professional artists and mentors, and they spend every waking moment preparing for the production. Amanda Yuan, has the female lead role.
I'm really tired, but it is so great. I mean, I'm not only having a lot of fun, but I feel like I'm really improving myself and I'm really working myself and pushing myself to the limit. And I'm constantly overcoming challenges and obstacles, which is a great feeling at the end of the day.
I've really felt like I've improved my craft with Young Artists of America. And this camp really has helped me do that as well and continue that journey. And I'll hopefully take those skills and continue that journey in college and beyond.
At the end of the two-week-long summer program, the aspiring artists showcase their talent and skills at a local theater. Sanz says some students will continue to shoot for the stars, but all of them will support and appreciate performing arts throughout their lives. For producer Jun So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. While you're online, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Chaz Hall, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you come back when you can. Have a great day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human rights monitors and the international community have expressed concern at the recent sentencing of Chinese human rights defenders, whose professional activities were labeled by the government as subversion of state power. In July 2015, over 300 human rights lawyers and activists were arrested, interrogated, and detained in a nationwide campaign against the legal community. 1 year later, more than 20 were still in custody. Recently, several of them, including attorney Wang Yu, appeared on video or in televised trials renouncing their past activities and confessing to being influenced by so-called foreign forces. Chinese authorities announced that Ms. Wang and her husband and fellow attorney Bao Longjun were released by authorities on bail, although questions remain concerning their whereabouts. In early August, four of the rights defenders were convicted by a court in the northern Chinese city of Tianjin and given sentences ranging from a 3-year suspended sentence to 7.5 years in prison. The four include attorney Zhu Shifeng, director of the Beijing Fenghui Law Firm, which was known for defending dissidents and religious minorities, Zhu's associate Zai Yanmin, and rights activists Hu Zhigen and Gu Hongguo, who were associated with Christian house churches in China. Human Rights Watch called the confessions of the four men coerced and their trials a miscarriage of justice. Amnesty International said this wave of trials against lawyers and activists are a political charade. The Chinese authorities appear intent on silencing anyone who raises legitimate questions about human rights and uses the legal system to seek redress. Director of the U.S. State Department's Office of Press Relations, Elizabeth Trudeau, issued a statement calling the charge of subversion of state power against the four rights defenders apparently politically motivated. She noted that more than a dozen other attorneys and activists detained on or around July 9, 2015, including Li Heping, remain in pretrial detention without access to their families or to legal counsel of their own choosing. The Chinese government's campaign against lawyers and rights activists undermines China's development of a judicial system that respects the rule of law, Ms. Trudeau said. We urge Chinese authorities to release the lawyers and rights defenders who are imprisoned or in detention, including those already sentenced. We call for an immediate end to the cases brought against them and to restrictions on their freedom of movement and professional activities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.